Before continuing this afternoon, just wanted to check in whether anything had arisen over lunch that you wanted to clarify. No? We're all abundantly clear. This is good. So I'm going to just... Sorry, please.
I've been thinking for myself. There's hundreds of ways that I can express ill will in my mind. When I drop that, I don't have hundreds of ways of expressing metta or rupa. It seems I drop it, but there's nothing much to replace it except the actual dropping of it.
I think you probably are missing a piece here or overlooking a piece, I would think. Now, you know, my suspicion is that when we first learn to relinquish something that is unhelpful to us, but that has perhaps been a historical companion, you know, and a very familiar mode of being, that the shifting out of that place, I think, is a transition. And at first, it wouldn't surprise me if there's a sense of kind of just disorientation almost, you know, like, what now? What now? And it's also, you have to remember, there's a lot of charge and there's a lot of energy in ill will. You know, sometimes they're the most wakeful moments of our days, aren't they? Sad to say, but they are characterized by a certain amount of energy. We don't kind of sort of feel sort of, you know, vaguely, vaguely hating, it's passionate. It's passionate. And so transitioning out of all of that, that familiar historical, I think there is an expected place of disorientation where we almost anticipate that something else might come rushing in. I think it's very important to befriend that disorientation, you know, rather than immediately thinking about, oh, okay, what comes next, you know, or waiting for the epiphany or, you know, the dawning of boundless metta. I think there's a place of really befriending that kind of sense of disorientation. I mean, the truth is there's many moments in our day when ill will is not present, and we tend to overlook them because I feel they are not characterized by that energetic burst and that energetic flavor. And we tend to either gloss over them, or we kind of numb out a little bit, or we're leaning forward into something next. And I think there's a great skill and a great wisdom in learning to pause in that place and to really... You know, it's so interesting in the suttas when the Buddha speaks about these moments of non-ill will, these moments of non-cruelty. I mean, one way of seeing that is simply a language weird thing, you know, that it doesn't quite bring himself to say metta or compassion. But I think there's also more, there's also an encouragement there to know the absence, to know the absence, to know the absence of ill will. And what is the mind in that place? Now, initially, it doesn't automatically flip into metta. It doesn't automatically do that. I think there's a befriending of that disorientation. I think that is sowing the seeds of inclining the mind towards befriending. I think that's the ground in which metta and compassion actually grows. But of course, metta and compassion are just as much an investigation as ill will is. You know, and that genuine curiosity about what it is to befriend, what it is to abide, to make our sense, our home in that sense of care, you know, in that sense of befriending, of intimacy, of closeness. So I would suggest it's simply transitional. You know? And sometimes we get impatient with that place, you know, because somehow something dramatic should be there, whereas actually it might be very quiet. Very quiet. Yes, please, Tim. No, it's not. It is now. Now it is. My mic is on now. Yeah. But you can hear it even better now, right? Okay, so yes, please.
Could you please go over that succinctly? Not, it seems so important, but I missed so much of it.
Oh, okay. So the question was around, you know, when in those moments we are able to release ourselves from the hold of ill will, that sometimes it feels an unfamiliar place, and it's not automatically a transition directly into boundless metta or boundless compassion. And first of all, I just wanted to point out that there are so many moments in our day when ill will is not present. But ill will has a lot of charge to it, has a lot of energy to it. So it's often very wakeful. So when that disappears, the moment often initially, I think, appears slightly flat, you know, and perhaps even slightly disappointing, you know, because we were hoping that ill will would fade away and there'd be some great surge of unconditional metta. And I think it's a disorientation. And I think it's very important to befriend those places. And, you know, the languaging of non-ill will and non-cruelty, I think, is actually so important, because it is pointing out to the fact that we do not live in a perpetual state of rage. You know, we do not live in a perpetual state of clinging. We do not live in a perpetual state of harshness. But those moments when they are not present, they're often actually get surrounded or just layered over with a kind of, sometimes a kind of dullness, and sometimes a kind of numbness. I think we need to learn to befriend those spaces, because that is sowing the seeds of metta, is to care for those spaces, to be intimate with them, to be close to them. And that is the ground in which metta really begins to deepen and to strengthen.
So then, is the reverse as true? If your heart is filled with metta,
yeah,
but yet there is no place for it to land, is not there.
Yeah. And that's what I call episodic metta. You know, and I don't think those moments are unfamiliar to us in our life. You know, we suddenly see a beautiful sunset or the laugh of a child, or, you know, something just touches us and delights us, and there's a kind of a surge of warmth and a surge of care. And the same is true of joy and compassion, that we often glimpse episodic moments of them. But again, if the foundation of understanding is not there, they tend to be episodic. You know, so we stumble from an episodic moment of metta to a familiar visit to ill will, to another episodic metta, you know, to more familiar ill will. And that doesn't fit with the Buddha's teaching, really, of inclining the mind towards as a pathway, as a cultivation, as a training based on discernment, based on investigation, based on understanding, so the metta can actually have the ground in which to grow. Yeah. Yes, please.
Sort of a question about sort of taking action in the world. So assuming that you're not acting out of complete greed or ill will, I don't find that I often have times when I'm acting and everything is pure and driven snow. Even with good intention, there could be something else. I mean, you know, even the desire to be acknowledged, or the desire to be right, or something like that, which doesn't necessarily negate the fact that what you're doing is good. But I just was wondering about what kind of yardstick you might use to make a decision about doing something like that.
You mean other than ill will? Other than anger. I mean, the question is really about ill will being a motivating force to actually bring about some positive change or helpful change.
Not necessarily, I guess it's more about just this idea that sometimes you're acting in the world and what you're doing could be right and you could have good intention, but but it's not only your pure.
All right, okay, okay.
A desire underneath that to be acknowledged.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So talking really about this situation, I'm sure familiar to many, of a kind of mixed intentionality, you know, that yes, there's the wish to help and the wish to relieve suffering, and I'd like somebody to notice. You know, that paradigm. And don't be surprised by that. I would say, if we waited until we had absolutely pure motivation, we could wait a very, very long time. And actually, you know, in terms of I find the Buddha's approach to this really helpful. You know, because he acknowledged that these mixed motivations can exist. He says, you don't wait until you feel something before you do something. You know, he said, if you want to know about generosity, be generous. You know, if you want to know about kindness, be kind. You know, if you want to know about compassion, be compassionate. And I remember once, you know, with one of my early teachers, you know, somebody, you know, objected to this, and they said, "I don't feel like it. You know, I don't feel like being kind today." You know, and my teacher sort of scratched his head and says, "What's that got to do with anything?" And, you know, what the Buddha really stressed is this kind of interplay between our actions, our body, and mind, you know? I mean, we can see how, for example, because Buddhist psychology never talks about mind and body, it talks about mind-body. So you can see, for example, very, very clearly how the mind is shaping somatic experience. You know, the dull mind, the body of dullness. You know, the agitated mind, the behavioral agitation. But he says this is not a one-way street. He says, so behavioral action is also shaping the mind, you know? And that's why he says, you know, you don't have to feel generous. If you want to know about generosity, be generous and see how that action informs the mind. So although there may be a mixture of intentions there, what's actually taking the lead or what you're hanging your hat on is what you know to be aspirational, that leads to the end of affliction. And that is actually what has the effect of releasing that other piece about, look at me, look at me. And it's not that you take care of that first, and then you act with clear and healing and caring intention. Okay, so let's move on a little bit. But okay, so I want to just go back just one verse because it sets the stage for the next. It says, "Bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, whatever a bhikkhu or bhikkhuni frequently thinks and ponders about, this will become the inclination of their mind. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of sensual desire or craving, they have abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. And then their mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of ill will, upon thoughts of cruelty, they have abandoned the intention of non-cruelty. They have abandoned the intention of compassion, of metta, to cultivate the thought of cruelty. And then their mind inclines to thoughts of cruelty." I find this, you know, such an important investigation because it's almost like what does it say about what our mind is doing and why that we would cherish the causes of affliction over cherishing the ending of affliction? That's a curious one, isn't it? And that's a really big question. And, you know, perhaps you can think of examples in your own life, you know, where that actually you might have known that and experienced that. You know, perhaps someone offends you and you really kind of really deeply value, you know, the end of alienation, the end of confrontation, but only after I've got the last word in. You know, or only I've said my piece, and I'm quite happy to put it all down. Have you noticed situations in your life where there's that sense of almost this attachment almost this investment in those intentions of anger or impatience or ill will, or you know, this investment in them over the cherishing of the ending of affliction. That's a very human kind of challenge, isn't it? It's humbling. It's humbling. It's kind of embarrassing too. It goes on to say, just as in the last month of the rainy season in the autumn, when the crops thicken, a cowherd would guard their cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that to check and curb them. Why is that? Because a cowherder sees that they could be flogged, imprisoned, fined, or blamed if they let their cows stray into their crops. So too, I saw in unwholesome states danger, degradation, and defilement. And I saw in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, of unbinding, and of relinquishment. Now, I want to think about how that lands. I mean, many of you, if you've come from any kind of sort of, you know, religious background, you may have had flavors of, you know, don't do this because it's going to end up, you know, in hell realms or, you know, in something terrible happening to you, and you're going to be very, very ashamed. And yet the Buddha was always interested in our looking at outcomes. Not from a perspective of somebody else punishing us or, you know, degrading us, but looking at the outcomes. And, you know, for me, what it was really curious, you know, I mean, I'm very aware that, you know, we tend to live in something of a shame-based culture, you know, where people are so often made to feel ashamed for being not good enough or for being wrong or somehow just for being born, even. You know, and we have such a propensity toward shame. But you know, there's a dimension of shame in Buddhist psychology which is really acknowledged as wholesome shame. If you can reframe that in your mind. As a wholesome shame. And I actually think we have all experienced this. Have you ever found something blurting out of your mouth that's hurtful and you feel that flush of remorse or regret? You know, in Tibetan, it's actually called being red-faced with regret. But I'm sure that's not unfamiliar to anyone. You know, that we've done or said something that's hurtful to another, and immediately there's just that really cellular feeling of, oh, wish I hadn't. And this is, in Pali, this is called hiri. It's wholesome shame. And it's actually encouraged as a virtue. You know, and my own feeling, and this might sound very weird, I think we live in a world really short of wholesome shame. You know, that we can be so heedless in our words or so heedless in our actions that can so lead to the affliction of others and the affliction of ourselves, but we can become so kind of numb to that or self-righteous that we don't actually feel, ah, oh, no, that was actually unwholesome. That was actually unskillful. You know, this is actually something to avoid, which is why I keep my cows in the right pasture. You know, I don't let my cows go in that pasture where, you know, it's going to lead to difficulty and degradation and defilement. You know, I'm keeping an eye on my cows. My thoughts. I'm keeping an eye on my thoughts that they're in a pasture where they will thrive, rather than in a pasture that's going to lead to all kinds of outcomes that are terrible. But this is also something to actually be able to see in the unwholesome, whether it's ill will or harshness or cruelty. You know, this diminishes our sense of inner self-respect and care and integrity. it actually diminishes our sense of inner respect. Which is why the Buddha says, you know, we should appreciate that the blessings of wholesome states, the blessings of relinquishment, the blessings of unbinding, you know, the blessings of being able to live aligned with what we most deeply value, to actually appreciate the happiness of that. You know, one needs some kind of sense of, you know, what is it that leads us, inspires us to go down one pathway rather than another pathway? You know, and in some way, the inspiration comes from the happiness of relinquishing, the happiness of unbinding, the happiness of knowing that our lives are truly, and our speech and our actions are actually in the service of bringing affliction to an end. But it goes on, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute. So I just want to pause with those three words. Diligent, ardent, and resolute. The Pali is apadama. It has this sense of tremendous enthusiasm. Right? Doesn't say kind of show up vaguely interested. Diligent, ardent, and resolute. Ardent, think about that word, ardent. You know, usually it's a word we associate with falling in love, isn't it? We're ardent, we're filled with ardor. There's a sense of great passion there. Diligent, taking incredible care, being as impeccable as we can be, and resolute, determined actually, really committed to following a pathway. Now, I would really encourage you to think of these three words, because they precede almost every instruction that the Buddha gives. They precede everything that the Buddha talks about in waking up. They precede the whole of the way that we cultivate the pathway. Diligent, ardent, and resolute. Now, what difference do you think that makes? Are kind of like, I'm vaguely interested, and if things work out, I'll be a little bit enthusiastic, you know, but I'm feeling kind of lukewarm. Diligent, ardent, and resolute. In the people you admire most in this world who've brought about the greatest transformations, you know, social, political, spiritual, how would you characterize those people? Diligent, ardent, and resolute. What is it that kind of subdues that in ourselves, if it is subdued? And how important is it? How important is it to, you know, we can be so ardent about lots of things in this life, can't we? You know, getting my new car, you know, I'm really passionate about it, you know, or rearranging the conditions of my life, I can be really passionate about it. Do we feel that about waking up? And what subdues it? What subdues it? That's a question. We're going to go around the pole here.
Diligent might substitute for desperate.
Ooh.
Desperation. You know, knowing that Dukkha doesn't work. That, you know, you can find yourself at the doorway or the in-between place.
Doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, it's not going to work. But yet, not in the door yet. That would be like letting go of the thoughts, having presence, and then maybe being disappointed. That's kind of where I find myself.
I mean, it's... I don't know if you heard the question. The question is about the word diligence also possibly being a sense of desperation, born of a sort of genuine, moments when your world just crumbles unexpectedly, or, everything you've kind of sort of relied on suddenly is disappointing and doesn't deliver what you thought it would, those moments are sometimes even the death of a loved one or the unexpected loss can, I think for many people, awaken that a sense of urgency, I would almost call it, the sense of urgency to find a more sustainable way of living, but more an alive way of living and an awake way of living. I think the only place I would be slightly cautious about in that is that urgency, again, is too often episodic in people's lives. It can be provoked by a sense of crisis. But then when things calm down, the ardency and the diligence tends to sort of fade with it. So I would just be slightly cautious around the word desperation. But, in a sense... I mean, in terms of refining motivation, I mean, the Buddha did talk really about practicing as if your life depended on it. That kind of diligence, that kind of remembering and recollection rather than heedlessness. But for me, diligence also means about carefulness. And taking care of the small things. I'm attending to, rather than forgetting or neglecting or dismissing. Yeah. Did you have something? Yes, please. No, I think that's a very good point. You raised the sense that doubt is one of the saboteurs of enthusiasm and ardor and diligence, the doubt of not being quite up to the job, and so the doubt kind of, creating a sort of more measured way of being, and it is, it's certainly one the most paralyzing of all of the hindrance and veiling factors, and pretty much all doubt, it seems to me, is rooted in self-doubt, and I think we're taught that. I think we grow up in that culture. I mean, I know many people in the path I've heard are kind of discouraged from having too high expectations. For most people, this is not the problem. It's too low. It's too low. And how that really dilutes enthusiasm and ardor. And, the thing is that that's actually where you practice enthusiasm and ardor, and I don't think we should just think of these as being given states. I think we actually practice and cultivate enthusiasm and ardor and passion really in the midst of doubt. That's that sense of being unswayed by the mind state or the belief system of the moment. And they can coexist, despite what the Abhidhamma says. They can coexist. Yes, please.
I think that there are a few things. One is wanting instant gratification, just meditating and practicing and then thinking, okay, you know, there's going to be transformation now. And so that's one thing. Another thing I think is not having a supportive community. I find that it's super important to have sangha.
Yeah.
And, you know, to talk about what's going on, you know, almost on a daily basis, really. And then the other thing is just life and, you know, like the pace of life for pretty much everybody I know is just, you know, out of control. Very, very long hours, familial obligations, you know, elderly parents, young children, and to make it a priority to practice is difficult.
And that, I mean, so the 3 points. One, the desire for instant gratification. The other is the inspiration that community brings, and just the other diluting factor, I mean, just the pace of life with so many demands that make it difficult to practice. I'll go from the last one, because again, we have to question what we mean by practice. Do we mean how many hours we clock in on the cushion, or do we mean how many minutes and moments do we remember? Yeah, I would go for the second one, by the way. Again, I think we tend to have this very institutional sense of practice that it's all about how many hours I've clocked on my cushion, which is such a reason. That would be disappointing and discouraging for anybody. Coming back to the second one, which is around inspiration, this is incredibly important. You know, I think there's such an orientation in Western Dharma to approach the practice with the word work. You know, it's another piece, another work thing to do. You know, I've got to work on my issues. You know, and I've got to work on my difficulties, and I have to work on myself. You know, and I feel that is actually incredibly joyless, quite honestly. I think, you know, you think of the difference between, you know, and it's where the whole word meditation really should be erased from our vocabulary, because it's also not an accurate translation of bhavana. You know, I think the moment we get into the word meditation, we're getting into something I'm doing, whereas bhavana is to cultivate and to bring into being. For me, this feels far more joyful. You know, every time I sit on my cushion, or don't sit on my cushion, and walk down the road, what is being cultivated in this moment feels far more dynamic and far more inspired than, you know, what I've got to work on. I mean, there's a lot in this practice about developing wise mindfulness and wise attention, but I think without the inspiration element, we tend to jump into a kind of forced attentiveness, you know, trying to be attentive. You know, if you think about the factors of wise attention, it's interest, intention, leading to wise attention. You know, but interest ties in so much with inspiration. You know, what is it that interests me? What is it that leads me to want to be engaged? What is it that leads me to want to be present rather than asleep? You know, what is it leads me that wants to learn, that wants to, encourage me to inquire, to investigate, to feel like I'm on a pathway of learning and deepening, you know. And, you know, recently I was teaching a module with some of my colleagues, and it was supposed to be one of my colleagues made up the title for this module, which I didn't understand at all until I got there. And then he says, oh, this is about up close and personal. This is about what sustains us in our practice. You know, and I was a little, took me aback a little bit, and I thought, you know what sustains me in 45 years of practice is I actually love to learn. I actually love to learn. And I'm not just talking about book learning. I really love to learn about what's going on here. And by the way, the first 20 years are the hardest. After that, it's really fun. Seek your inspiration. Seek your inspiration. Never sit on a cushion without inspiration. Whether it's reading a verse from a poem, whether it's having stepped outside to look at the sunset, whether it's listening to something that inspires you, never sit on a cushion without knowing what you're doing there. Because you will just be ticking the box. Feel that sense of something. You're growing something very alive here. You're growing your aliveness. Amen. And that needs that inspiration. This goes on. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, as we all are just now, a thought of unbinding arose in me. I understood this. This thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction or to others' affliction or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, doesn't cause difficulties, and leads to nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and a day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed. And when the mind is disturbed, it is far from collectedness. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness. Why is that? So that my mind should not be disturbed. This relates to something one of you asked earlier about dwelling upon the wholesome. Who was it that brought that up? Yeah. About dwelling upon the wholesome, yes. You know, is it okay? You know, you have a wonderful thought of generosity, or, you know, you have a wonderful thought of care, or you've just had a delicious meditation, you know, or you've suddenly noticed, you know, your mind is very collected. Is it a good thing to dwell upon the wholesome for a night and a day? And then even dwelling upon the wholesome feeds the tendency of the mind to dwell. Feeds the mind. And it's so interesting, this formula, that, you know, that with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body's tired, the mind becomes disturbed. And when the mind's disturbed, it's far from collectedness. And when the mind is far from collectedness, it's deeply vulnerable to difficult states of mind taking hold. So, yes, we are undoing the habit of dwelling, even upon the wholesome. Just keeping an eye on the time. Okay. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of non-ill will arose in me, a thought of non-cruelty arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of non-cruelty has arisen. This does not lead to my own affliction or to others' affliction or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, leads to nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this even for a day or a night, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering again, I become tired, the mind becomes disturbed, and it's far from collectedness. So, going to move on a little bit. Bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of their mind. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of renunciation, they have abandoned the thought of sensual desire to cultivate the thought of renunciation. Because see, here we're talking about a change of course, aren't we? We have abandoned the thought of sensual craving in order to cultivate the thought of relinquishing or unbinding. We're not going to be doing both at the same time. And then the mind inclines to thoughts of relinquishing. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of kindness, upon thoughts of compassion, they have abandoned the thought of cruelty and ill will to cultivate the thought of non-cruelty. And then their mind inclines towards non-cruelty. You know, there's a kind of formula that Jnanapanika Thera coined. He says, in terms of awakening, to think of these three steps. The first is to know the mind. The second is to shape the mind. And the third is to liberate the mind. The knowing of the mind we've talked about, that simple knowing of what is going on. Shaping the mind. It's recognizing that the mind in every single moment of our day is being shaped by something. It's being shaped by our mood, shaped by our thoughts, shaped by our views. It's being shaped by both the unwholesome and by the wholesome. To know the mind, to shape the mind with the inclinations of relinquishing metta and compassion, and to liberate the mind. To liberate the mind from the hold of confusion, of clinging, of ill will. Just as the last month of the hot season, when all of the crops have been brought inside the villages, a cowherder would guard their cows while staying at the root of a tree or out in the open, since they only need to be mindful that the cows are there. So too, there was only the need to be mindful that those states were there. You see the transition that's being made? From the poking and the prodding of the cows, to keep them from straying into unhelpful pastures, you know, the kind of effort that was being needed in that training, the kind of care that was being needed in that training, as the mind was beginning to make this transition from being in the grip of ill will and cruelty and clinging, being so, so careful with where the thoughts were going, you know, really extending that care, extending that effort, extending that mindfulness. And then guess what? There's the out-breath. The mind is trained. It doesn't want to go there anymore. The mind is trained. It is it's making its home in those three wise thoughts, those three wise intentions. It has become disenchanted with ill will and cruelty and clinging. So the cowherders relax. They're just hanging out. They don't need that vigilance. You know, the cows are content, you know. They're in a rich pasture. Why would they go somewhere that is unhelpful to them? Is that permanent? Probably not. Maybe so. I would hold both. We see that is so sometimes, isn't it? You know, when the mind, when the heart is really contented and really established in metta, compassion, non-clinging, you know, you don't have to be so vigilant, do you? But it's also not a time for being heedless. Also not a time for being heedless. But then there's that kind of relaxing until the next verse. It wasn't the end of the story. That wasn't the end of the story. So we'll have a little bit of a pause moment, and then I think we'll take half an hour for some walking. Are there any questions, any reflections? Okay, so the question, I think it's an important one. It's just a noticing that in the more unwholesome states of ill will, of cruelty, of clinging, the sense of a pronounced sense of me is quite powerful and quite strong. Whereas in the wholesome states, there's hardly a trace of me there. You know, and this is very true, and I think it's something really important to notice in our own experience, you know, how the volume of selfing gets turned up in the unwholesome, you know? It's so rave, I'm so angry, you know? And it's all about me, you know? It's all about me. And one feels the sort of the passion and the kind of sense of, you remember that verse I wrote, read right in the beginning, house builder? You know, house builder. This house that is being built is my house, you know? It's my house. And even though it's incredibly painful, at least it's mine. When we move into the wholesome, but you also notice in the house, in the selfing, and the voluming of selfing, equally the voluming of the other and the reification of the other that I'm angry at, you know, or that I really dislike. So self-building doesn't just happen inwardly, self-building happens outwardly also. It's good, really important to notice that. That as I build a self inwardly, very often I'm building a self outwardly. I'm building a self in people, but I also build a self in things and in events and in experiences through desire, through craving and through ill will. I build a self in things and people and events and experiences because I'm positing in those things and experiences the power to make me angry, the power to make me unhappy. So self-building is never just, it's really important to notice this, it's never just an internal affair. Self-building is always in relationship to an other, and the other is another kind of self-building that is being built through anger, through rage, through craving, through clinging. Okay, so this self-building happens in the unwholesome. Now, it will happen in the wholesome if there's clinging to the wholesome. You know, if you know, we have a genuine moment of care and friendliness and affection, and then, oh, that was really good, you know. It was really good. I mean, if there's clinging to the wholesome, even the same self-building process will go on. But when there's no clinging to the wholesome, the voluming of self in goes down, which actually can be both absolutely beautiful and delightful and liberating and also a little bit scary because I'm homeless. I am homeless. I cannot make a home in the wholesome without clinging. Whereas I make a home in the unwholesome easily because clinging is always attached to the unwholesome. But I cannot make a home. I cannot build a house. English language here is very difficult, by the way. There can be a learning to abide in the wholesome, to dwell in the wholesome, without making a home out of them, without making them mine. We see the way in which, you know, we do want to centralize a sense of self in all things, and this is one of those deceptive ideas of safety, is identity. It's a deceptive idea of safety. It's also, of course, a place of great affliction, both for ourselves and others. Yes, please.
How I'm understanding this right now is that I don't see opposition if I'm holding, I'm just focusing on the values, and that if values are, you know, there's not,
not a sense of them being so under siege or to be defended.
Right.
Okay. So the sense of, I mean, I think the question is how important it is or how significant is it to actually taking the time to reflect and to deepen the appreciation of what we most deeply value rather than feeling like the world is always there somehow besieging my values. And so I'm defending against, that's the bulk of my energy, is defending against that. I mean, it's important to remember that, you know, the actual, this word sati, or mindfulness, initially had the primary connotation of remembering. Now, that remembering had a lot of different dimensions. You know, first of all, it was, because it was an oral tradition, it was about remembering the teachings. And when it came to a meditative translation, it became a present moment recollection. But its initial translation was all about remembering. And remembering the teachings is about remembering really the heart of the teachings, about awakening, about peace, about compassion, about the things as human beings we actually, when we're clear enough, do value the most deeply. Now, we're easily made forgetful of that. You know, and it's almost a way that remembering is almost in this creative tension with the tendency towards forgetfulness. And often what makes us forget is often when we just seem to lose our way, or we're, you know, our Thanksgiving dinner. That's my class. I mean, I had Thanksgiving dinner with my extended family this year for the first time in, I don't know, 50 years or something. And I just thought, this is the weirdest thing I've done in a really, really long time. I mean, I love them all dearly, but I had not a single thing in common with anybody there, except that we were the same family. And you know, one could really see in that, you know, the voices that say, you know, why aren't you doing this, and why, and, you know, nobody in my family knows what I do, so they think I'm some sort of waste of space, you know. So, you know, confronted with all these ideas, you know, like, why aren't I doing this, you know, why aren't I doing that, and why aren't I doing this, and, you know, and I'm sort of thinking, you know, remember what you value. Remember what you value most deeply. This will guide you through your day. This will guide you through a world with a sense not of defending, but with a sense of what can be offered and what can be shared.